I'm Kevin Kelly, and this is Live and Local, your connection to local music and more. And on the program today, I'll be talking with singer-songwriter Shawn Colvin. She is going to be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts on Friday evening. And we'll hear some of her music and have a nice chat. And later, then, I'll be talking with Louis Bergonzi, who is conductor of the University of Illinois Philharmonia and also a professor of music education there. They're giving a concert here in Urbana, also on Friday night. Hope you can stay with us on Live and Local. We just heard a song called This Must Be the Place with Shawn Colvin, who is my guest on this portion of Live and Local, well-known person in the singer-songwriter business and lots of other areas of music, both on her own and in collaborations with other people. She's going to be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts on Friday at 7:30 in the evening, Friday the 29th, and pleased to have her on the phone with us. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
And where are we finding you right now? I'm not sure.
I'm home. I'm in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. Lots of musicians gravitate to Austin. How did you gravitate there?
They do. Well, music took me here actually quite a while back. I initially moved here in 1974 and then spent some time mostly in New York for many years, then came back here 20 years later in 1994. And I've been here ever since, and it was music that brought me here both times.
And the music, I mean, something specific about Austin musically?
Initially, yes. I was in a band that kind of modeled itself after Asleep at the Wheel, and it seemed like the place to come. You know, we were a country swing band. The second time, not as specifically, but I knew it was a music-friendly town and that I would find camaraderie here. and they had great radio stations. I was just going to leave the city. I needed to leave the city.
Meaning New York City.
Yeah, and I came here. My sister lives here as well.
Well, no, that's helpful. Mm-hmm. My own sister used to live there for quite some time. She's now up in the Boston area. One of the attractions there for her was the music scene in lots of different ways.
Yeah, it's very healthy.
And, of course, we on our station, WILL TV, our companion station, we broadcast Austin City Limits, which always has lots of different musicians there. What is the music scene like? What's the breadth of it, and where does your style fit in?
Well, that's a really good question, and I am not the greatest person to answer it anymore because I'm a parent and have a 13-year-old daughter, and my handle on the music scene is not what it used to be. I don't get out much. The last thing I saw was Lady Gaga, okay? So if that gives you any idea of what, you know, how things have changed. But I do have several friends in town that are professional musicians. Patty Griffin is one of them. And I, you know, keep up with the scene to some degree, not like I used to.
And you're obviously doing lots of your own solo work, but you've worked with many other people. What makes you decide when to collaborate with somebody, or when somebody is appealing that you think you'll fit in well with what they're going to do?
Well, it's just an instinct that you have, and then good timing always helps, and it doesn't always work, but most of the time it does.
What makes it work? I mean, what makes you decide that it did work? What's a measure of whether it works or not?
What's a measure of success?
Yeah.
Well, the bottom line is, you know, you want to, assuming that you have any objectivity because you're involved, but you know what I mean?
That can be very difficult.
It can be very difficult. But the bottom line is, so, I mean, your friends liking it is helpful, but the other bottom line is just, does it, you know, move you in a basic way? Are you getting, does it feel emotional? Does it feel honest? It's kind of the litmus test, as near as I can tell.
What's the bulk of what you do now? Is it you mostly on your own?
Yes.
Mostly with your band?
No, I don't really have a band. I mean, if I needed to go out tomorrow and put together a band, I have ideas about who I'd call, but it's just me. That's the basis of how I tour.
And that's what people are going to get when they hear you in Bloomington.
That's what they're going to get.
You and your guitar.
Me and my guitar.
And you like it that way the best, obviously.
I think it's unique. I think it's something that I do well, and my experience has been, when I like an artist and that's something they can pull off, there's nothing quite like it, you know? I mean, if I go hear Richard Thompson and he's playing by himself, there's something sort of extra special. I mean, he's phenomenal with a band, but, you know, that intimate kind of thing that happens with a solo performance, if you're comfortable with it and good at it, I think it's really special.
Well, and from an audience point of view, there's nothing like that sort of one-on-one communication. I mean, each person in the audience can feel that they're communing with you one-on-one in a way, I would think.
Yeah, and there's much less, there are less, what's the word I want, walls. You know, I mean, when you're on stage with the band, you've got other people to relate to on stage. You've got other sounds you're listening to, worrying about, reacting to, and you know, when they've got you by yourself, it's just you and them. I mean, you're not talking to anyone else up there. You're not, you can't hide, and people feel that.
The tracks that I actually got from the Bloomington Center are all with other people, with a backup of sorts. So I want to play one of these other one of these tracks I do have readily available, and we'll put some in a little later, called Shotgun Down the Avalanche, which is an interesting title. Where's that come from?
You know, it came out of the blue. I was writing the song. I overheard someone say that they had said to their mother, "Come on, Mom, don't have an avalanche." And I'm like, okay, well, avalanche is kind of a good word. Maybe I can use it.
Is that sort of like a breakdown, presumably?
Pardon?
Is that sort of like a breakdown or a conniption fit or something like that?
I think it's some kind of meltdown is probably more like it. And I kind of went with that, and that line just came out of my mouth. I'm writing Shotgun Down the Avalanche.
And here it is with Shawn Colvin. She's going to be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts Friday night, 7:30. And we're talking with her here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. It's called Shotgun Down the Avalanche. It doesn't roll off the tongue exactly, with Shawn Colvin.
I don't have any problem with it.
Well, you studied it, and I my writing is terrible, and so I wrote this down, so what I think is happening. anyway, Shawn Colvin is going to be at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts Friday night. She's with us here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And you're coming back sort of home in a way. To Illinois, having gone to university in Carbondale. And I read here somewhere that your first professional gig or semi-professional gig was at the University of Illinois.
No, I don't know who, I don't know where that came from. You're not the, you're the second person that's said that they read that somewhere, and it's, I don't know, it, they just, someone must have just messed it up, because no, it was, certainly it was not U of I, it was SIU.
It was SIU, well, that's what I wondered.
Yeah.
SIU Carbondale.
Yeah.
What'd you choose Carbondale for school?
Well, I lived there. My parents moved there when I was 12. And I went to junior high and high school there.
And
so
one
that's
how
I chose Carbondale.
Yeah, and well, you could easily have gone away. That's certainly what I decided
to
do. But there
was a very healthy music scene in Carbondale.
There you go.
And I wasn't sure what I wanted to study with, you know, and I ended up really kind of just dropping out. Not kind of, I did drop out of college and pursued music.
What was the music? What was, which aspect of the music scene were you in initially?
Initially, I just played solo, like I do now, at several clubs downtown that would have solo performers. And then I had to put together a trio, and then I put together a band. And we would play the clubs that people would come and dance at.
And so you've always been in the singer-songwriter end of things. Did you start doing covers, or did you start doing your own stuff?
Well, I wasn't. I wasn't really. I did all covers back then. I didn't really write much. So I just did covers of all the singer-songwriters that I grew up listening to. And then once I had a band, we did... Fleetwood Mac was very popular. We did some reggae. We did band versions of things by Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and just a smattering of stuff. And I didn't really write anything that you would hear me do now until in the mid-'80s when I was in New York City.
And that's because you just don't think so much of the stuff you wrote at first, now?
Well, I wrote some stuff when I was a teenager, but I didn't, and then I kind of just drifted away from it. I loved good songwriting so much. It just didn't come naturally to me. I could sing, you know, the things that came easily were the things that I stuck with. I could sing and play very easily, perform in front of people very easily. All that was easy. When it came to writing, I clamped up. And I paired up with a guy named John Leventhal in New York and started co-writing with him. And that's kind of how I got to the point where I felt like I found a voice.
How did you recognize that point where you said, I think
it
this is
several
happening?
Years. It was one particular song that I was working on called Diamond in the Rough that opens my first, no, it doesn't open my record, it's the second song on my first album called Steady On. And I co-wrote that with John. I went, this is the direction, this is the right way to go.
Did you co-write the words and the music, or one or the other?
No, just the, I wrote all the words and the melody, and he had written all the music.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed it. I did, and I'll see you again next time. Thank you.
And the next time for you could be this very Friday evening at 7:30 at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. That was Diamond in the Rough with Sean Colvin here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We'll continue with our conversation with her in just a minute. Our broadcast today is made possible in part with support from the Danville Symphony Orchestra presenting Flamenco Fire with guitarist Robert Michaels this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. in the Danville High School Auditorium. Music includes Gershwin's Cuban Overture and Michaels' Flamenco Selections. More information is available from the Symphony office at 443-5300. That song, Diamond in the Rough, one of the very first songs co-written by Sean Colvin with John Leventhal, and it shows up on her first album. We heard it off of her live album from 2009, and we were talking about her collaboration with John Leventhal. Do your songs generally start with the words?
No, they can. But a lot of times when I hear some music that he's written, especially, I will hear words that go with the music. And certainly on occasion, yes, I've written the words first and then kind of put them into some other piece of music that he's had, or I've written words and music together by myself at times.
So is he still your main collaborator with writing?
Yeah, he is.
That's a long time collaboration.
It is a long time collaboration, and I spoke to him today, and I said, "Shall we get together and do some writing?" And he said, "I will sit down and write with you till the day I die."
That must have been very sweet, especially.
That was very kind. Yeah.
Well, especially, I mean, so that started when? It's been how long that relationship
started,
has
like
gone
81.
Yeah. So, what do you think has made it successful? Why would he say that? And would you say that to him?
It's a little, yes, I would say that. It's somewhat mysterious. We, you know, if you'll excuse the pun, struck a chord in one another when we met. I just loved his sensibility. That he's a great guitar player, and I loved the sensibility of his guitar playing. And then found out that he wrote music, and as soon as I started hearing the things that he wrote, I was coming up with ideas of lyrics. It's just inspiring. Like that is simpatico, you know? Something works. It's kind of hard to define.
We've had a number of guests on the show lately who are duos, and they started out as musical partners and ended up as life partners.
We started out as life partners.
And then went the other way.
Exactly.
One, so we know which one worked better, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt.
What
happened?
Well, I shouldn't ask that. I was going to say, why did one work and the other one didn't?
Well, it's not mysterious. These things tend to fall apart, you know, and everybody has different reasons why, but they're just personal. And we were pretty young, you know, we were in our 20s, and it just, you know, was just not meant to be. It wasn't good timing for that. But the music part was always the connector and the strength, and that remained.
Well, that's obviously that strong that didn't break with the rest, which often happens just as often.
It did momentarily. There was a record that I did not make with him because I just needed to kind of get away. And I still had some songs that I co-wrote with him on that record. It was the second record I made called Fat City. But then we got back together, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, and everything was fine.
Do you have 2 or 3 favorites that you've done with him over the years that just stand out for you?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, I have more than 2 or 3 favorites. There's songs that we've done together that I'm, you know, very proud of. Diamond in the Rough, obviously. There's a song we wrote called Wichita Skyline that I just have a real soft spot in my heart for. And then the songs we wrote on the last record we made called These Four Walls, I just think they're as good as anything we've done. I love the songs on that record. I love playing them, and I still love listening to the record. I thought we did a great job.
So you do listen to your own records. A lot of people don't.
Not much. Not much. But I I mean, it's been a long time since I've listened. I just wanted to listen to the latest, the last studio record that I made, because I've got it right now for another record. And I kind of wanted to see, okay, how did this go? How did this work? And remind myself what we were doing and how we did it.
And is that so that you can kind of do it again, or so that you can do something different?
I think it's whatever it leads to. It was just part of the process for me. It's like, all right, let's listen to the last thing. And, you know, where is it taking me? You know, it's like listening to the themes of where I was, and I don't see myself making a huge departure from it, honestly.
After, 5 years can be a long time or not a long time.
Oh, I know. No, I take notoriously long time.
Well, what I meant is it can be a long time where enough things have changed in your life that you could never, whatever the next album would be so completely different.
Well,
from that.
Exactly. And for example, the difference between a record I made called A Few Small Repairs and then the next record after that, which was called Whole New You. Both John and I had kids.
Which was 5 years.
Yeah, which was 5 years, and we both had kids during that time. So,
well, I'm actually looking at this pattern here. There's between that one and Whole New You, 5 years. Between that one and These Four Walls, 5 years. Between that one and the next one, well, between now that one and now, 5 years. That seems to be the period.
Yeah,
that's
a gestation
period. So, folks on Friday will be hearing a lot of songs with you and John Leventhal. Will they hear some of the ones you mentioned just now? Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah,
for sure.
Will.
Well, we will definitely go out with one of those you mentioned.
Okay.
Seems fair and reasonable, and I really appreciate your having taken the time to talk with a novice in this this side of music.
No, I appreciate your interest, and I'm looking forward to coming to your area very much. So it's like a piece of home for me. So
I'm looking forward to it. I really enjoyed discovering it when I saw that you were going to be at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, and I listened to a lot of songs, and I thought, no, there's somebody I really want to talk to.
Oh, thanks.
And it's going to be at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, Sean Colvin, Friday night, 7:30. For more information, you can go to artsblooming.org, and that'll get you to the main stage page. And the tickets are there. And for more information on Sean Colvin, it's just seancolvin.com or org? .com.
Com.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Sean Colvin, Wichita Skyline, from her live album of 2009. And you can go see and hear her live Friday night at 7:30 at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. I've been to a show or two there, and it's actually a great place to see shows. Beautiful space, nice acoustics, and pretty easy to get to as well. And for more information, you can go to, Arts Blooming is the easiest way to remember, artsblooming.org. And find the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts main stage page. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and haven't really had a chance, because we didn't have all the figures in, to say thanks to the 946 listeners who called in pledges of support last week. Well, ended early last week and the previous week. Your participation made our spring membership campaign quite a success. You helped us raise over $125,000 to support WILL, which is, of course, your local public radio station. If you missed our pledge week, you can still help WILL reach our April campaign goal, which is equally as important as meeting our pledge goal. Pledge drive goal. You can make your online contribution right now at willpledge.org. That's willpledge.org. And next on Live and Local, I have with me Louis Bergonzi, who's professor of conducting and music education in the strings area at the University of Illinois School of Music. He is also conductor of the University of Illinois Philharmonia. They're giving their spring concert as this spring semester wraps up. Friday night at 7:30 at the Kraner Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. And Louis, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been around here how long now?
This is my sixth academic year.
And you came, were you told part of the deal up front was you would be conducting this ensemble, I assume?
Yes, indeed. That was one of the attractions of the position.
Yeah, as opposed to... Where you were? You were at Eastman.
I was at Eastman.
Not a pretty attractive place, isn't it?
Very attractive place. And unfortunately, I was just, I was limited to music education. And if I wanted to be a musician or conduct, I had to travel to different states and do the all-state or honors orchestra jobs. So I was dating a lot of orchestras, but here I was able to marry one.
And it's been a successful marriage?
From my point of view, I've really enjoyed it. I enjoy the chemistry of the students who come from all over campus and how they mix in with the music majors who have a sort of focus on this rehearsal and other things during their day that have to do with music. But the campus majors come in and sort of look to that hour rehearsal as a way to escape molecular biology.
So when you say campus majors, you mean majors in something other than
music? Other than music, right.
Although you probably have some music majors in your ensemble or not really?
Particularly in the winds and percussion, that's mostly music majors. But in the strings, it's mostly campus students.
And so that's the big difference between the Philharmonia and the U of I Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, the U of I Symphony is, the vast majority of players are music majors. Rarely will a campus major first be accepted and then second have the time to commit to that top orchestra.
Do they rehearse more often?
Don Schleicher's Symphony Orchestra rehearses 3 times a week, 2 hours each, and we rehearse 4 hours a week.
Twice a week.
So we overlap 2 of their 3 rehearsals.
And you perform how often?
We perform twice a semester, and UISO performs 4 to 5, including an opera per semester.
Do you conduct all the concerts, or do you ever have any of the Don Schleicher students conduct, or you conduct, or your students conduct?
We do feature the Masters of Music in orchestral conducting. The students in that program often have a piece, or sometimes even a half of a program. Mm. And so they'll rehearse the group and present part of a concert. Both orchestras rehearse at the same time. So if we need to share conductors or horns, we can use the resources that way across the orchestras.
And otherwise, your duties at the U of I are teaching string music education.
I teach string music education and some graduate courses in music ed sociology. And I'm chair of the music ed department.
Which is not a small...
Not a small job. The undergraduate music ed program is about half the School of Music.
It's funny that you said at the beginning that you came here from Eastman in large part to become a musician again. It seems kind of unfortunately common, at least from my minimal observation of schools of music ed departments, where the music ed professors sit at their desks or teach classes but don't really make music anymore? Or is that becoming less common?
Another option is actually becoming more common. That is, they'll be at their desk, but they'll also be out teaching in schools in partnership with a local school teacher. So if they're not performing music, they're performing music education. One of the strengths of the music ed program here, I do one of the orchestras, and Joe Grant for many years did the Women's Glee Club. And so, but you're right, it is a sort of, as music ed became more professionalized and dependent upon credentials, there was less opportunity for faculty to be musicians as part of their job. Many work in community bands or in church choirs. I'll never forget, I was guest conducting the Virginia Allstate, and one of my undergraduates from Eastman was there teaching in Fairfax County. And at the break, she came up to me and she said, "Well, why during my 4 years at Eastman didn't I know you did this?" And I said, "What do you mean, this?" She goes, "I didn't know you could conduct." And it was, I thought about it, and it's weighed heavily on my mind that it was true. She had never seen my relevance in an orchestral rehearsal or concert. And so without that understanding, she saw me in a certain way. And one of the beauties of this job, as they crafted it, is that the students do see me as a musician as well as a teacher.
What kind of difference do you think it has made in your teaching, being able to be a musician in front of them, or at least they have the opportunity to,
sure,
so that nobody can say anymore, "Oh, I didn't know you actually made music."
Right. Well, it gives me some credibility in that regard. And as you know, in rehearsal, things come together in your head in ways they don't just by thinking about them. In the process of preparing a concert, I'll make in my head connections between something theoretical and something at the moment. And so it's a real rich setting for me to think about teaching, because so much of what a conductor does is instruct and prepare and forecast and review. So it does provide opportunities for me to sort of synthesize what I think about with regard to teaching. My favorite teaching environment is the Illinois Summer Youth Music Program, which happens on campus for high school and middle school kids. And there, for a week, it's really my magic or mysterious laboratory. I can really experiment with different ways of teaching string players and reviewing things in a way that when I'm in front of teachers at a professional seminar, I'm supposed to be the expert. It's not the time for me to experiment. But in the basement of Cranert for 1 week in the summer, I'm allowed to fool around and try out different approaches and put them in a test tube and see how it works.
I had the chance to see you work with some young kids, high school kids primarily. It's been a few years ago now, where you were working with the strings of the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra,
sure,
in a retreat setting. And you used a lot of humor during that rehearsal. Hmm. Is that something you commonly do?
I think I use it to a greater extent if I'm new to the group. If I'm an unfamiliar person, it's sort of as a way to introduce myself. And so as the group comes to know me and I the group, I don't have to be that entertaining. But as a nice way to meet someone, if there's some humor, it relaxes everybody.
And you also borrowed the concertmaster's violin quite often.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat to the discomfort of this particular concertmaster for some reason.
Right. That must have been one of the days where I forgot to ask in advance if I could borrow the student's,
yeah,
violin. I usually do that before we even start. But, you know, music is something we hear, and string technique is something we can see. So talking about it really is not taking advantage of what it really is. So if I show them and they hear it, and they hear the sound, and then they see how the technique looks that gets that sound, that's worth more than I could ever say with verbal description.
Was violin your instrument, or is violin your
undergrad
instrument?
Violin and viola in graduate school.
I often have thought that as a conductor myself, that's a weakness that I can't really demonstrate anymore. I mean, I never did play the upper strings,
mm-hmm,
and it's not very practical, nor would it sound any good anymore for me to, you know, grab my French,
sure,
horn and start blasting away to demonstrate something where you have to. So then I'm stuck with having to describe a sound,
mm-hmm,
which can be sort of difficult.
Yeah, very. But for instance, instruments, I'm not able to just pick up and demonstrate the oboe. Well, it's not a good example because there are only a limited number in a group. But an articulation or something, the peer demonstration, you know, having that concert mistress who didn't like it when I played her violin have her do the demonstration for her peers accomplishes the same thing.
Hmm.
So I use a lot of peer demonstration.
You're, of course, here to talk about the Philharmonia concert, and I'm just sort of getting sidetracked with,
okay,
the whole idea of music teaching. You've got a couple of, well, a few American pieces. Well,
all right, American.
It's all American program, including a brand new piece. Before we talk about any of that, let me just play one of the pieces that will be on that program. It's by Charles Ives, and this is a movement from his Fourth Symphony that does occasionally get excerpted. Mm-hmm. Let's just listen to it, and then we'll talk some more. It's the third movement, the fugue. We'll hear part of it from the Fourth Symphony of Charles Ives. This is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. And we're talking with Louis Bergonzi, conductor of the University of Illinois Philharmonia, who are giving a concert Friday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. It's live and local. Just a little sample of the fugue, the third movement from the Fourth Symphony of Charles Ives, with Michael Tilson Thomas leading the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. That movement will be on a concert by the University of Illinois Philharmonia Friday evening at 7:30 at the Krannert Center, conducted by Professor Louis Bergonzi, who's with me on Live and Local right now. And we'll hear a sample maybe of music of Henry Cowell. If we have time, we'll certainly hear some music of Bernstein. You've got a couple of pieces on this program. How did you decide this particular program, and why an All-American concert?
It's All-American, but it's America in a diverse kind of way. The Cowell is a look back to him and Fuguing Tombs of colonial America, and sort of the first indigenously grown American sound and American music. And then the Ives, of course, how Cowell and Ives going back musically and personally as a nice connection. And then the piece by Jury Saw, who is a doctoral student in music composition at the School of Music, sort of represents, here she is. She's a doctoral student in an American university, born in Taiwan, was in my Philharmonia years ago as a cellist. And it just seemed sort of her profile sort of pulled a lot of pieces in about the Philharmonia that I enjoy, and about where we are, composers coming from the academy for the most part, sort of the antithesis of Ives, if you will. And so Jury's piece starts the second, ends the first half, and then the Bernstein is two Bernstein pieces of the second half. But Bernstein, the composer of musicals and movie scores, and also an opera. So it shows the multi dimensions of American music historically and in other aspects of history.
Are you able to talk about what Jury's piece is like?
Sure. It's tonal. It starts off, it uses all 12 tones in the opening statement, but it's not realized using 12 tone techniques. It's a tonal piece, easy to follow. Has the orchestra and I have been hearing a little bit of Shostakovich. We heard a measure or two from Rite of Spring. So it has, she was a younger composer in 2008. And this is a piece she wrote for Philharmonia, I believe. And we gave its first performance. I don't think it's a style that she would say represents where she is now. And when she first composed the piece, the title was Movement, Classical Movement. And I asked her what she meant by classical, because it's late Romantic, modern sounding. And she said, well, it's for acoustic instruments. So for me, that's classic.
Instead of
electronic instruments. I said, that says a lot. So now it's just called Movement. And again, it's a style that she's moved away from, but it certainly is great to play, and listeners have a good time following it. It's definitely a piece you can grab onto.
And you pronounced her name Saw.
Saw.
Saw, but
Saw.
It's sort of transliterated, spelled S-E-O.
Mm-hmm.
You put in your notes to me here, Ash.
Ash.
I'm guessing that was a...
Ask.
That
typo.
Was probably
ask,
a dyslexic
maybe?
Sort of typo thing. Yeah, it was probably S-A-H.
Ah, S-A-H.
Yes. I wondered if that's... It's
Saw.
Is that what her name meant or something like that? Or
it's,
yeah, okay. Now it has all been revealed. At least nobody knows what I'm talking about, but this is why I'm looking at this email, and it was sort of odd. Well, it sounds like a fun program and a nice representation of, she said American music early,
as
popularly,
seen, right,
and and now. And so is her music often electronic? Was that sort of the implication there?
Yes. Yes.
And here at the University of Illinois, which is one of the founders of electronic music, you can even read a plaque right out in front that talks about that. Thanks very much for coming in. And it's a free concert, yes?
Absolutely.
Is it free? Kreiner Center,
so it's not free.
Very inexpensive.
Yes,
indeed. Very inexpensive. University of Illinois Philharmonia, 7:30 on Friday, Kreiner Center in Urbana. Music by Henry Cowell, Charles Ives, Jury Saw. And then two pieces of Bernstein. And we'll go out with one of those in just a moment. I do need to say that our program today on FM 90.9 is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 2 to 6 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. And this is Illinois Public Media, WYL FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana with translators, W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. We're a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Join me for a live show in our studio tomorrow from 12 to 1 with University of Illinois Vocal Jazz Group. We'll have a live combo with us and a number of vocalists. They're done at the direction of Darden Purcell. That'll be on our show tomorrow from 12 to 1. Let's go out with the third of the three dance episodes from music by Leonard Bernstein for On the Town. Bernstein himself leads the New York Philharmonic.